From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. John Densmore was the drummer with the Doors. He says lead singer Jim Morrison's self-destructive behavior nearly destroyed everyone else in the band. On today's Fresh Air, Densmore remembers his days with one of the most popular rock bands of the late 60s. Also today, Richard Werman offers some advice on information anxiety. Reporter Stefan Salisbury reviews this week's developments concerning government funding of the arts. And writer Barry Lopez joins us to read from his essay about a lapse in our collective memory. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Today's American evacuation flight from Kuwait wasn't as full as had been expected. Several dozen passengers were not permitted to leave Iraq. Terry Phillips reports from Baghdad.
Among those evacuees flying to London was Thomas Ewald. He's the human shield recently released after his mother wrote a letter to Saddam Hussein. The chartered 747 was to take more than 400 Americans from Kuwait City today, but the turnout was smaller than anticipated, and some of those trying to leave did not have proper identification. Embassy officials hope to fly yet another group of U.S. citizens home tomorrow. Meanwhile, diplomats from France, Canada, and Belgium were detained in Kuwait City today. Iraqi troops made the arrests during house-to-house searches for Western men hiding in the region. A spokesman for the American embassy says U.S. diplomats in Kuwait were not among those arrested. For National Public Radio, I'm Terry Phillips in Baghdad.
Iraqi state-run radio reported today that a so-called popular tribunal will be convened in Iraq next month to try President Bush. The report didn't specify what crimes the president was to be charged with. Iraq has blamed President Bush for food shortages resulting from the United Nations blockade. Baghdad Radio quoted a prominent lawyer as saying that preparations for the trial were made by a committee of Iraqi jurists and human rights advocates. The tribunal is to convene on October 15th and last for 4 days. As the 8 o'clock deadline looms near, many staffers at the New York Post, the city's 189-year-old daily, are cleaning out their desks. The paper's owner, Peter Calico, is prepared to close down the New York Post if the daily's 9 unions fail to agree to more than $18 million in wage and benefit concessions. Carol Zimmer reports.
Hoping to provide inspiration this afternoon, John Cardinal O'Connor met with union and management representatives in an effort to save the New York Post from shutting down its presses for good. The paper's owner, real estate entrepreneur Peter Calico, who took over the New York Post 2.5 years ago, says the cuts must be made in order for the paper to reach a break-even point. So far, operating the paper has cost Calico more than $100 million. Many analysts think that New York City, the only city in the country which still supports 4 metropolitan dailies, will see the demise of 2 of its papers in the near future. And if the New York Post shuts down, those analysts say the losses will not only affect the city's financial climate, but it is likely to lower New Yorkers' morale as well. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Zimmer reporting.
Stock prices fell today on Wall Street in reaction to new government figures on rising inflation and falling retail sales. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 19 points to close at 2,564.11. Declines led advances by nearly 2-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
You know, the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, break on through to the other side, yeah.
The band The Doors explored the dark side of life in the late 1960s. The band took its name from a line in a William Blake poem about opening the doors of perception. A cult following developed around their lead singer, Jim Morrison, who wrote lyrics about his obsessions with sex, death, and insanity. He lived a life of excess and died of a heart attack in 1971 at the age of 27. My guest, John Densmore, was the drummer of The Doors during the 6 years they existed. He's written a memoir about that time called Riders on the Storm. A feature film about the Doors will be opening next year, directed by Oliver Stone. Densmore was a consultant for the film and has a small part in it. Jim Morrison died and was buried in Paris. John Densmore didn't attend his funeral, but he did visit his grave in 1975. I asked him to describe what the gravesite looked like.
Well, definitely old Europe, with moss-covered gravestones and cats scurrying into crypts, cobblestone lanes, and then the graffiti, Morrison this way, acid lives, carved into tombstones near Baudelaire and Edith Piaf.
What did you find disturbing about what you saw?
Disturbing. Well, as you read, I'm kind of angry at Jim, and it took me, dare I say, a couple years to get there, you know. I'm angry at his self-destruction, and by the end of the book, I'm more philosophical, as I am now, and I was angrier then, and this book was a 10-year catharsis, and does that answer it?
Well, I think, you know, that you were not only angry with Morrison, but it sounds like you were angry at the people who glamorized his craziness.
Well, he said that he consciously and unconsciously built the myth. I think what he meant unconsciously was, you know, the media tends to really get going. But he was a smart guy, so he dropped lines like, think of us as erotic politicians, and that's a good hook, of course, and writers go, hey, and off we go.
Do you feel like at the time you played into that glamorization at all?
Well, we wanted to make it. I mean, we wanted to be as big as we could. We also wanted to say something. We wanted to make a living and all, but we really hoped to say some things. One wonders whether it went too far. This question, well, if you had to do it over, would you do it different, always bugs me, but I usually say, well, of course I would do it different, because hopefully I learned something by what I went through. But by the same token, if I did it different, I wouldn't like who I am now. So, next question.
Let me ask that one again, though. I don't think we really got to the answer
here.
Did I get around that? Yeah.
Let
me ask this again. Do you think that you personally participated in the glamorization of Morrison's craziness?
No. I played my drums, and I tried to quit.
To quit the band?
Mm-hmm. I let Jim know that I didn't like what was happening, and around the third album, I threw my sticks down and said, I'm out of here. And I came back a few days later, a career and something I was real passionate about, music, and didn't know what to do. I was a drummer, and I loved what we did together, and that was my angst, that being in a band with a wild man.
It must have been awfully hard to really walk away from a band like the Doors.
Yeah, that's why I came back.
You said that Jim Morrison courted insanity and nearly dragged down the rest of the band with him. How did he court insanity?
Well, Jim tested people. He certainly was into substance abuse. When you have a good friend and you also create something together that's even bigger than the two of you or the four of you, you'll go down that road a little further than you should, maybe. I don't think I went further than I should, but I definitely pulled back and wouldn't go drinking with him. And other books have said I wasn't Morrison's friend. I loved the guy, but I hated him for his self-destruction, and I had to take care of myself and pull away the last few years.
How much of the Morrison image do you think was a pose, and how much of it do you think was kind of out of his control?
Well, that's a good one. Oh, 50-50.
Yeah, what's the percentage?
Maybe in the beginning, certainly it was more I hate the word pose. I mean, he did get posy, certainly, but he was smart, and he knew what he was doing, and he wanted to free up his mind as well as others. I love this thing he said about don't let people talk you out of your pain. That's part of you. Carry it around like a radio. Turn it up, turn it down, or whatever. Don't let them deny your pain. You know, the guy was a seeker. And maybe around the time when he penned, "I am the Lizard King, I can do anything," he turned a corner where the myth that was building, he started buying, or it started running him instead of the other way around. I thought back to when John Lennon wrote, "I'm not the walrus, I'm John," which is sort of more of a grounding kind of statement, as opposed to, "I'm the Lizard King, I can do anything."
John Densmore is my guest, and he was the drummer with The Doors, and he's written a new memoir called Riders on the Storm. Now, you are from a middle-class suburban background, and you say that music rescued you from that background. What did you feel specifically it rescued you from?
Well, that was coupled with a Catholic upbringing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the 60s certainly were freeing in terms of sin.
If Morrison was the Lizard King, what was your image in the band?
Well, I wrote that at home in suburbia, it was the Ozzy and Harriet show, and I was Ricky. And the other day, a writer said to me, "Whoa, the book strikes me as Ricky Nelson Goes to Hell." I thought that was good. And back, thank you.
Tell us how the Doors got together, how you met the other musicians in the band.
Robbie Krieger and I were dabbling in psychedelics back as far as when LSD was actually legal. And this was before I smoked grass. And so I was real open and innocent and having wonderful transcendental experiences, but realizing that it's pretty hard on the body and it should be treated carefully, like peyote is sacred to the Indians. So Robbie said, "I heard about this meditation class." So we went to Maharishi's transcendental meditation class a couple years before the Beatles. Ray Manzarek was there. He's our keyboard player. He came up to me and said, "I hear you're a drummer. You want to rock and roll?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." And he had his brothers playing guitar. They dropped out. They couldn't quite see Morrison's vision or see his potential, because when I first met him, I went down to Ray's parents' garage, and this guy was lurking in the corner with bare feet and a T-shirt and real good looking, real shy, and had these incredible words scribbled down on matchbooks. And so it began.
What were your early shows like when you started to play together as a group?
Well, the first club was the London Fog, a real sleazy place where we kind of were really just honing our stuff, and Jim wouldn't even face the audience. He was so nervous. We had this sort of circle of energy that we developed in rehearsal, and he didn't want to break it. Then we moved on to the Whiskey A Go-Go, became the house band, and we really opened up then, and we played everybody, the Byrds, Captain Beefheart, Van Morrison, Frank Zappa. And as every group came in each week, we'd kind of, well, let's show them how good we are. And then the record people start coming around.
You write that when you started playing music, it wasn't yet cool to be a musician. It was cool to be an athlete, but not a musician. Mm. Then you become a musician, and it's real cool to be a musician. And I'm sure there were always groupies, you know, backstage or trying to get backstage. Were you surprised at quite how cool it became to be a musician?
Yeah, I didn't get it. I thought I was supposed to be a nerd, and now I'm cool. So I'm going to go back to high school now. Because it's cool, isn't it?
John Densmore is my guest, and he was the drummer with The Doors, and he's written a new memoir, and the memoir's called Riders on the Storm. You say that meeting Jim Morrison was the death of your innocence. When did you first start thinking of him as actually psychotic?
Well, I suppose the first incident was when I took him to his girlfriend's house, and I went out for a little while and came back, and the front door was ajar, and I kind of pushed it open, and Jim was holding a kitchen knife to Rosanna's stomach. Ha, ha, ha. He put it down and laughed as if it was a joke, and she was sort of laughing but sort of scared, and I thought I was in a band with a psychotic. And then I thought, I'm in a room with a psychotic. And, you know, I told Robbie, our guitar player, what am I doing in this? But this feels like it's so magical. That was the beginning.
Did you ever talk to Morrison about these things? The things that disturbed you?
Not that much. You know, the 60s were not big on verbal communication. They were more big on smoking joints and saying, far out, man.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is John Densmore. He was the drummer with The Doors. He's written a memoir about that period of his life and his life afterwards. It's called Riders on the Storm. This is Fresh Air. Drummer John Densmore is my guest. His new memoir is called Riders on the Storm, My Life with Jim Morrison and the Doors. I want to ask you about a now very well-known incident that happened during a Doors concert. And I'm thinking of the night that Jim Morrison said, let's see a little skin, let's get naked. So what happened after he said that?
He did not expose himself. It's true, Jim was drunk. He was getting into alcohol heavily. And he had just seen Julian Beck and Judith Malina's Living Theater, which was a very confrontational thing where they said, no passports, no visas, no boundaries, and they walked around the audience in little G-strings. And he was kind of fed up with us having to play the hits, but he was also getting burnt out, unfortunately, from substance abuse. So Miami, he tried to interject confrontational theater into our performance. Didn't tell us, of course. And he stopped songs and said things like that, and things like, don't let them shove you around in the S dot 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 of the world. And he took his shirt off and ran around, and he threw a cop's hat in the audience, and the cop threw his hat in the audience, and there's a lot of people on stage, so a security guard flipped him into the audience thinking he was a fan. It was real chaos. But sorry, folks, no exposure, no oral copulation. Jim didn't play an instrument, and he was real enamored with Robbie's guitar picking, as I was. He played flamenco, Robbie did, and it looked like a crab crawling across the strings. So he would get down on his knees and look at that, and hence we have obscenity charges. We paid the police for the hat, and everything was fine. We were laughing, left town for 4 days, and then we get these warrants. I think maybe some kids went home, I don't know, drunk or missing a shirt. And the parents, what is this? What have you been at? Let's call up the politicians. Let's get reelected. Well, yeah, rock and roll. It's moral decay. Let's get them. And then we have 30,000 people in the Orange Bowl with Anita Bryant and Jackie Gleason rallying for decency. We didn't play that one.
Oh, you didn't play their rally, huh? Now, what did you do on stage when the police came on stage?
Well, I abandoned the stage when I heard it crack on the left side. Oh, and before that, there was a can of orange day glow paint thrown on us. Quite a, Oliver Stone's trying to duplicate this, so.
Oh, in his film about the Doors. Yeah.
So I jumped off the stage, and I landed on the light board, and the whole thing collapsed.
Did the lights go out when that happened?
Just the stage lights. We're talking chaos, Terry. I remember going upstairs and watching Jim, you know, as I said, he got flipped into the audience, and the kids weren't hurting him or anything, and he started leading this kind of snake dance, and everyone was behind him, and it was wild from above. It looked like a whirlpool.
Did you hurt yourself when you fell on the light board?
No.
What did you do after you got up? Did you...
I ran up the stairs.
You were able to get away? I mean, it sounds like it was so chaotic and crowded.
Yeah, yeah. The stairs were right there going up to the dressing rooms.
And what did you say to Jim Morrison the next time you saw him?
Well, I didn't say much to Jim, you know, because I was intimidated by him at this point. And he came up and was sort of laughing, and I thought, oh, well, concert's better for a hangover than aspirin, okay. I was mad at him, you know, quite mad, because musically it was terrible. Theatrically, well, but I wasn't into theater then.
Oh, but you are now, right?
Yeah, I wrote a one-act play and stuff. So.
A different kind of theater in a way, I guess. Yeah. Well, at least it's one you're controlling. Now, what effect did these charges of lewd and lascivious behavior have on the band?
Well, it really ruined our live career for a year or so. And our manager said, oh, we've lost $1 million. And I'm thinking, good. I don't care. This is a runaway train here, and Jim's in trouble, and no one's stopping him. Not that he could be stopped, but we're all turning the other cheek or something because of commerce or some rubbish. I don't care, you know. Let's defuse this myth-building insanity a little bit. So that's what I felt.
So you stopped touring for a while because no one would book you?
Oh, yeah, a long time. But, you know, we could still record where we had control. If Jim was too loaded, we could shut down.
What changed that around? What opened up concerts to you again?
Time heals. I guess a year later or so, we started getting bookings, and we purposely booked smaller kind of Philharmonic halls, 5,000 seats, where the acoustics are better anyway. But it was too late. I remember Dallas was... a good gig. We played Riders on the Storm, and it hadn't been released yet, and we got a good response, and I thought, well, maybe we can have a new career here as kind of subtler, jazz-oriented, and, a little more sophisticated. But the next night, Jim was pathetic. I just didn't have it at all, and finally, Ray and Robbie agreed to pack in the live performing, which I was trying to get to happen for about a year.
John Densmore is my guest, the Doors drummer and author of a new memoir called Riders on the Storm, My Life with Jim Morrison and the Doors. Did you go through a self-destructive period when you were with the Doors, and did you used to get loaded a lot?
No. I'd certainly dabbled. There was always an example of too far to go right there in front of me, so I was pretty careful. But I still have a drink now and then, and... moderation seems to be my key.
Were you ever resentful that that Morrison got so much more attention than anyone else in the band did?
When we got the artwork for the first album cover, I thought to myself, well, why is his head so big? You know, it covered the whole album, and I'm like in the corner. And then I thought, okay, well, so I guess he'll sell more records. I'll sell copies of Soldier of Fortune, so I'm small. Yeah, you know, but then I see what that bright spotlight does to you, you know, and I'm going, oh, okay, I'm glad I'm kind of just on the fringes here, getting just a little singed.
What were the immediate effects on your life when Morrison died?
I shoved it under the rug. I was so angry with him anyway. I mean, I was definitely very sad when Robbie told me, and I looked in Robbie's eyes, and I was pretty sure it was true. You know, there had been fake death rumors and stuff. And Robbie said he's finally achieved peace. it took me years to kind of grieve over him, and this book has been a lot of that stuff. So I continued playing music, and then I kind of got into acting, which got me into writing, which got me into getting out some of these feelings.
It's interesting. From your book, I know that you were introduced to the thinking of the poet Robert Bly.
Yeah.
And you got very involved with male sensitivity, male energy, getting in touch with the female side of the male, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is about as opposite as you could get from Jim Morrison mm-hmm. as possible. And it seems to me that that's no coincidence. I mean, do you see your interest in that as being like a reaction to Morrison?
Jim was not quite as macho as he appears to be in those leathers. If you look at People Are Strange, you see really vulnerable lyrics. And so he could get it out that way, and he had a real sensitive side. And fortunately, Val Kilmer, the guy who's playing him, has that side, thank God, because Oliver Stone writes the other side. I was kind of a flower child type. I don't know whether I would be getting involved in the men's supposed movement is a total reaction to Jim, but it's good stuff. It's sharing feelings, and like women have always done. It's healthy stuff.
I'm sure thousands of people have told you stories about what your records have meant to them. How often do you listen to your old records?
Well, I don't listen to them at home, Terry. I've heard them a lot in the studio. But if I'm in the car and someone chooses to play it, I get a little kick out of it. Not like when I first heard, the first time I ever heard anything on the radio, I was like, oh, that's me, you know? And I looked at the car next to me and I, no. Are they listening? I think I'll roll down the window and turn it up. And I saw my book in the window of a bookstore a few weeks ago for the first time, and it was the same, it's a real thrill.
I think perhaps what surprised me most in your book was that everyone in the band really liked Jose Feliciano's cover recording of Light My Fire.
Well, what's interesting is that he made it a ballad. He totally reinterpreted it, whereas Billy Idol's doing L.A. Woman right now. And it's good, but it's kind of copying our arrangement. And let's see, Aerosmith's done Love Me Two Times. And
what's the worst cover recording you've ever heard, here or abroad?
Oh, God. Well, I mean, those ones I hear in elevators, I hear a bunch of strings playing Light My Fire, and I go, what?
It doesn't capture your experience, huh? Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been John Densmore, drummer for The Doors and author of the new book, Riders on the Storm, My Life with Jim Morrison and The Doors. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Yeah, come on.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, some suggestions on dealing with lots of new information without getting overwhelmed and over-anxious. A talk with Richard Werman. He makes a living organizing information in phone books, travel guides, and other reference books. Also, writer Barry Lopez examines what we lost when we lost our collective memory of life in North America before Columbus. And Stephen Salisbury reports on the latest developments in the controversy over the National Endowment for the Arts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. No injuries were reported today when U.S. and Australian warships fired warning shots at an Iraqi oil tanker in the Gulf of Oman. The Pentagon says a joint boarding party inspected the Iraqi vessel before allowing it to proceed. Since entering the Gulf region, American naval forces have boarded approximately 35 vessels to make sure they were not breaking sanctions against Iraq ordered by the United Nations. The U.S. consul in Kuwait was detained for 2 hours today by Iraqi troops who entered the Canadian embassy in Kuwait City. George Getter reports from the State Department.
In addition to the American, consuls from Britain, Ireland, Australia, and Canada also were detained. All were released when they established their identities as diplomats. The consuls had been discussing plans for weekend evacuation flights of Westerners from Kuwait. The State Department withheld the name of the American consul, who normally works at the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. Iraqi troops also invaded the diplomatic missions of France and Belgium. The State Department called the Iraqi action a flagrant violation of UN resolutions aimed at protecting diplomatic facilities in Kuwait. A month ago, Iraq demanded that these facilities be shut down. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
Secretary of State James Baker and Syrian President Hafez Assad have held talks in Damascus to discuss Syria's contribution to the international force in the Gulf. Western diplomatic sources say they expect Syria to send as many as 15,000 more troops to the region. The BBC's Gerald Butt reports from Damascus.
It's clear that while the talks were wide-ranging, they were also at times very tough. Speaking at Damascus Airport before leaving Syria, Mr. Baker said he and President Assad had discussed at length ways in which the two countries could cooperate to enforce UN resolutions against Iraq. He spoke, too, about how Syria had agreed to increase substantially the size of its military force in the Gulf. But Mr. Baker went on to say that they'd also had extensive talks about terrorism, and in particular, the bombing of the Pan Am airliner over Lockerbie in December 1988. The Palestinian Popular Front General Command, which is led by Ahmad Jibril and is based in Damascus, has been widely accused of carrying out that attack. Mr. Baker said that relations with Syria could never be characterized as close while what he called this problem remained.
The BBC's Gerald Butt. Supreme Court nominee David Souter spent a second day today fielding questions from the Senate Judiciary Committee. The 50-year-old federal judge from New Hampshire addressed the issue of abortion by telling lawmakers he will listen to both sides of any challenge to the landmark ruling that guaranteed a woman's access to abortion before making up his mind on the issue. President Bush today offered positive marks for his nominee to the High Court. On Wall Street, prices closed lower today, with the Dow Industrials closing nearly 19 points, finishing up at 2564.11. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Barry Lopez is one of our country's foremost writers on the subject of the natural history of our land, how we relate to it, and what that says about the bigger issues in our lives, truth, integrity, beauty. Lopez received critical acclaim for his 1978 book of Wolves and Men, and won the 1986 National Book Award in Nonfiction for Arctic Dreams. Barry Lopez joins us today to read an excerpt from his essay, The Rediscovery of North America, which he delivered earlier this year at the University of Kentucky. Lopez says many of us are predisposed, because of our social and economic history, to see the landscapes we inhabit in a certain way, which keeps us from really seeing what is there. And this has been a problem, he says, ever since the Spanish first set foot on this continent. Here's Barry Lopez.
The premise that this essay operates with is that when we arrived, Europeans, in the New World, we made a kind of financial assessment of the landscape, but we never inquired at the kind of depth that you need to inquire at in order to produce an indigenous philosophy. And the second premise is that without an indigenous philosophy, your politics and everything else are just never going to work. So at this point in the essay, what I'm trying to do is evoke some sense of the people and the place, the original inhabitants and the place as it continues to be. It may have been some time since you thought of how the land was peopled. Start in the Bahamas with the Arawak, and then come north and west to the mainland, to the country of the Calusa. Move on north to the separate landscapes of the Apalachee, the Creek, the Chickasaw. Then east and north, the Cherokee, Delaware, Susquehanna, the Onondaga, Mohican, and Abenaki. Back west, Huron, Ottawa, Chippewa, Plains Ojibwa, Assiniboine, Crow, Shoshone. Into the northwest, Salish, Nez Perce, Coeur d'Alene, Yakima, Snoqualmie, Chehalis, and down the coast, Tillamook, Siuslaw, Coos, Yurok, Pomo, Maidu, Chumash. Back to the east, Paiute, Havasupai, Papago, Pima, Chiricahua Apache, Mescalero Apache, Tiwa, Tano, Tewa, Keres, Santo Domingo, Powaki, Hikaria Apache, Kiowa, Arapaho, Pawnee, Kansa, Osage, Shawnee, and back, Hichidi, Timucua, Seminole. This is to leave out all the tribes of the north, Dog Rib, Hare, and Cochin, the northwest coast, Tlingit and Kwakiutl, of Mexico, Tarahumara, Aztec, Maya, and to the south of them, Mosquito and Kuna, and all of South America, from the Carib and the Timote to the Yahan and the Ona. More than 1,000 distinct cultures, 1,000 mutually unintelligible languages, 1,000 ways of knowing. How can one compare intimacy with the facets of this with the possession of gold? How could we have squandered this in that search? Imagine the physical place. It may have been some time, too, since you thought of this. The Florida Keys, that white light. Okefenokee Swamp, the Piedmont Plateau, James River, the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, hardwood forests of Vermont, Mount Katahdin, the Finger Lakes, Allegheny Mountains, Cumberland Plateau, Kentucky River, Indiana Dunes, Wisconsin Dells, Minnesota Lakes, Laurentian Divide, Shortgrass Prairie, Missouri Breaks, Judith Basin, Lolo Pass, Mount Rainier, Olympic Peninsula, Columbia Bar, California Redwoods, Tuolumne Meadows, Black Rock Desert, the Wasatch Range, Medicine Bow Mountains, South Fork of the Platte, Pikes Peak, headwaters of the Canadian, Sangre de Cristo, Mogollon Rim, Sonoran Desert, the Edwards Plateau, Brazos River, Big Thicket, Lake Pontchartrain, Chattahoochee River, Everglades. And I leave out again all that to the north, Thalon River, Great Bear Lake, the Brooks Range, Glacier Bay, and to the south, the Chihuahuan Desert, Yucatan Peninsula, Mosquito Coast, the Darien Isthmus, and South America, Lake Titicaca, Mato Grosso, Atacama Desert, Patagonia, Tierra del Fuego. It would take a lifetime to list even in these few places the trees and flowers, the butterflies and fish, the small mammals, the kinds of deer and cats, the migratory and resident birds, and to say the most rudimentary things about their relationships, how they know and reflect each other. This, along with the people we ignored, was a wealth that didn't register until much of it was gone, or until, like the people, it was a tattered, diluted remnant sequestered on a reservation. This brief litany of names, though all of them are imposed, should awaken a sense of the breadth of this landscape, how by turns it is strange and comprehensible, familiar and unfathomable. It is still, in some real sense, the new world. These places can still infuse minds with a sense of awe. They are still marvelous places with whom or with which we might reciprocate.
writer Barry Lopez, reading from his essay, The Rediscovery of North America. His new book is an illustrated fable called Crow and Weasel that's just been published by North Point Press. And he's just received the Lannan Foundation Award in nonfiction. This is Fresh Air. Does listening to Fresh Air and NPR's news programs ever make you a little anxious because there's so much information you want to know or need to know or think you should know? Is there just too much you have to read and watch to keep up? I know I get anxious just thinking about what I have to read for the next edition of our show. That's why I was intrigued by the title of the new book, Information Anxiety. It's written by Richard Saul Werman. He's an architect and graphic designer and author of a series of unusual city guidebooks called Access Guides. He's also redesigned the Pacific Bell Yellow Pages and is working on overhauling TV Guide. So I asked him to talk with us about information anxiety.
Information anxiety is that ever-widening gap between what you think you understand or what you think you should understand and what you actually can take in. And it's recognizable today. Everybody thinks they have it when they read the title of the book, not knowing exactly what it is, because there is this perception, this sort of perception of catastrophe, that there's so much more than you can handle, than you can read, than you can take in. And there's a lot of societal pressures, typically in a cocktail party, where people drop names, drop books, drop ideas, and you have to say, uh-huh, and you don't know what they're talking about. So there's a lot of pressures to think you should be understanding all this stuff because you think it is information. After all, it looks the way you were taught information looks like. The fact is, it doesn't really represent an information explosion, but rather an explosion of non-information, because most of the stuff you hear over the radio, see and hear on television, read in newspapers, isn't understandable.
I have to disagree with you here. I really think there is an explosion.
You don't have to disagree with me.
Well, I will anyways. I think there really is an explosion of information in the sense that, I mean, I subscribe to a lot of magazines that have wonderfully written articles in it that really explain things quite well. And if I had time to read more than the table of contents, I think I'd really benefit by reading this stuff. I mean, there's a lot that I think I ought to know, especially in the job that I do. And it's just impossible to keep up. And I think the problem for me isn't the fact that people aren't presenting information well. The problem is that to really keep up with what's happening in the world and in your life and in the lives of your friends and in the arts, it's virtually impossible. It's exhausting.
Okay, we're apart on that issue because there's substantive evidence of things that I haven't researched, but a lot of psychologists have researched, that the amount of information that you can take in that you're interested in, and mm-hmm. in an understandable form, they find almost limitless. That doesn't seem to be the human dilemma. The human dilemma is having information in an understandable form that interests us.
Now, one of the things you've done is to reorganize the California Yellow Pages.
Yes, ma'am. I call them the Smart Yellow Pages.
Let me tell you one of my Yellow Page frustrations. When I want to get my hair cut and I have mm-hmm. to look up a number, mm-hmm. I look under hair. And under hair in the Pennsylvania Yellow Pages, you have hair removing and hair replacement. But if you want to get your hair cut and you're a woman, you have to look under beauty salon. Mm-hmm. Now, beauty isn't the first thing that comes to my mind when I just need a haircut, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, I understand the problem, and that's exactly what I overcame in the directories out there. And if you want, I can tell you how we did it.
Yeah, please.
I had exactly the same problem, not with having my hair cut because I cut my own hair, but with things for my automobile, because I lived out there and you need an automobile in California. And I looked under all the headings that had something directly or remotely to do with my automobile. I went through all the headings. It was about 4,000 or 5,000. And I found there were several hundred, about 300. And less than 10% of them started with AUTO. I then looked at the major things in my life, like my house, health and well-being, kids, sports, certain business things. And I realized in these about a dozen big subjects, which have almost all the headings under them. So I put in the front of the directory a two-page spread on each of these 10 big, big subject areas, in which I listed all the things that had to do with your car. Now, I broke them up so that if it's a two-page spread on automobile, it has a group of things that have to do with repairs and buying and selling and insurance and legal things and parts and other kinds of vehicles, those kinds of things, so that you, once again, have an easier chance of looking at this kind of open stacks in the library approach. And they're called subject search. So you can look, if you don't know the heading, for instance, if you don't know the how to get your seats fixed or certain kind of electrical equipment or whatever, you can very easily find the heading on those two-page spreads. Now, if it has to do with health and well-being or I forget what beauticians and beauty and things are under, but it's under one of those personal care pages, it's easy to find all the things very easily. You can find it really easily. And it's just a more natural way of looking up something where the alphabet, although you can still find it if you know the heading through the alphabet isn't the only way to find things. We also have little map locator squares so you can find where something is in the city. And that's the third kind of way of organizing information. One is alphabetical. Two is by category, which I just told you. Three is location. Time is the fourth one, so you can find things that are open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or strange or unusual hours. So if you're up at 4 a.m, you want to know what's open in the city, what you can do, what you can eat, whether there's movies or a bookstore, you can find what's open 24 hours a day or 7 days a week or Sunday. And the last way, the fifth way of organizing information is hierarchical, and that really doesn't apply to the phone books because you can't really rate things as being the best or the worst because everybody has an even chance to advertise in there.
Another type of guidebook that you've rearranged is the Guide to Cities. And, for instance, they're called Access Guides, and mm-hmm. I've been looking over the New York City mm-hmm. Access Guide. Tell us a little bit about how you wanted to restructure the way city guidebooks are usually laid out.
Well, I wanted to know when I go to a city, something just as simple. I want to know where I am and what's around me. I want to go to a museum and see, when I come out of the museum, what's next door, or what's around there, where can I eat, is there another thing to see, another museum close by? Well, with a standard guidebook, which is primarily organized by category, you have a chapter on hotels, a chapter on restaurants, a chapter on museums. You go into a city, you're at a hotel, you never know, you go to the chapter on restaurants, you don't know what's nearby. You go to a museum, you don't know what else you can see because the arrangement of the information has nothing to do with the fabric of the city. So what we do in our guidebooks, or the access guides, is we put each entry next to each other as they are in the city. So you might have a page that has a restaurant, a hotel, a shop, a museum, four more restaurants, whatever. Then we color code the type so you can scan through each chapter, each section of the city, and see all the restaurants, all the hotels, all the museums. So it's primarily organized by location, secondarily by category, and there's a tertiary organization because we give 1 to 3 or 4 stars for restaurants and we rate hotels, and that's the organization by hierarchy. Again, I'm only going to these 5 ways of organizing information, and through different combinations from primary, secondary, tertiary, etc., that's how you go about solving almost every problem, to see which is the way in, which gives you the path into the information that's the clearest.
Explain what the syndrome is that you describe as overload amnesia, because I think I might have it.
Oh, my goodness. I think I don't have my book in front of me. If I did, it's probably worded better than that I'm going to say to you now. You should just probably have my book and read it out of what I say, because the words are better crafted than what I will say.
Is it that you don't remember?
No. I mean, I know it's when you take in taken so much, it seems to be, you take in so much that it pushes everything else out. But I think I have it better crafted in my book. So, yes, I probably don't remember to say it as well as I did it in the book, yeah.
How did you get into this kind of business of organizing information?
Well, I guess I just, I'm a self-starter. I like to do things myself, and I couldn't find anything around that I could understand. And I tend to like high-risk situations, so I just do them myself. It's really no great mystery, and I'm not trying to be cute about it. It really, really does stem from this just strong desire to understand things. I have a singular passion. I'm not well-rounded. I just, every once in a while, something gets me curious. I love watching television, and that's why I'm redoing the TV thing. I travel a lot. I'm doing a new airline guide for airline schedules. It just really comes from my very sort of primitive habits. I love watching the Olympics on television, and I couldn't stand the way they didn't explain them, so I did an Olympic guide to the summer and into the Winter Olympics. It really just comes from the things I want to find out about, and I look around to see if they've been done. If they've been done, I'm sure not going to do it myself, but if they haven't been done, then I decide that I'm going to do a book about it.
What's your favorite reference book, other than the ones you've done?
What's my favorite reference book? Oh, what a good question. Gee, I mean, I do like the Encyclopedia Britannica, but my favorite reference book, I guess my favorite reference book is probably the Daily Newspaper. And it's not a book, I know, but it's it gives me great joy to have that kind of serendipitous paper every day that I can go through and find things that I wasn't looking for. I always find a story that I didn't know was going to be there, because you don't can't predict what's going to be in the newspaper every day. In the same way, when I read Business Week, I always find something I never thought would be in there. They'd be writing about something I hadn't heard of. It's that kind of serendipity and discovery that I like. I mean, when I think of Encyclopedia Britannica, I think of the article next to the one that I'm reading, not the one I'm looking for. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's exciting about that. It's always the thing next to the thing that it's my primary search.
Thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Richard Saul Werman's new book is Information Anxiety. It's published by Bantam. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Today, our piece of the prejudice puzzle that we're considering has to do with the Eskimo Indians who live in Alaska, way out in the bush, and the way modern education affects their children. We're also going to be following the Secretary of State's visit to Syria. We have some very strong reaction from the families of Flight 103, which was blown up over Lockerbie, Scotland, to that visit and to our new interest and alliance and common cause with Syria.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The debate around the National Endowment for the Arts this year has largely focused on the House of Representatives, where legislation to reauthorize the endowment has been hopelessly bogged down. Meanwhile, the Senate has been quietly working away on its own reauthorization legislation. A few days ago, that legislation was unveiled with nearly unanimous support from its committee. Almost at the same time, an independent bipartisan commission appointed by Congress and the President issued its report on the endowment. Both the Senate bill and the commission call for an NEA with no restrictions on the kind of art it funds. Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Stephen Salisbury has been in Washington this week covering the story. Stephen, were people surprised that both the bill and the report didn't prohibit the endowment from funding various kinds of art?
Oh, absolutely. The Senate bill caught a lot of people by surprise. But while the bill doesn't impose restrictions on the art up front, it does give the endowment the authority to go after an artist if a project is found to be obscene by the courts. The endowment can then try to recoup its money. The senators simply felt that that it was unworkable and unconstitutional to give the endowment or to empower the endowment with making determinations of obscenity itself. That's a matter that should be in the courts. What was really startling about the Senate bill was that the committee voted for it 15-1. That represents a very broad bipartisan coalition, which was largely engineered by Senator Orrin Hatch, a Utah Republican who is known as a bulwark of the conservative bloc in the Senate. Hatch worked hard to build a consensus proposal. He won the backing of Nancy Kassebaum, a moderate conservative from Kansas who's been very alarmed at some endowment projects. Both of them worked with liberals like Ted Kennedy and Claiborne Pell to get the support of senators as ideologically diverse as Chris Dodd of Connecticut and Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. That's impressive. There's a feeling now that they have the momentum coming out of the committee to build an equally broad coalition on the floor of the Senate. The wild card, of course, is that no one knows what Senator Helms is planning to do. But anything he attempts will now face a proposal with some powerful supporters. Senator Hatch, for one, told me he intends to stick with this bill all the way through the floor debate.
What about the Independent Commission report? Will that have any political impact?
That's an interesting question. The commission's recommendations roughly parallel the Senate bill. It calls for no restrictions on art, arguing, like the Senate bill, that obscenity is a matter best left to the courts. In its own way, this commission report is just as remarkable as the Senate bill. Commission members cover a broad political spectrum, yet they unanimously came together behind a proposal that calls for no restrictions. Their report could have a direct impact on the political impasse in the House. It's hard to say. There are all kinds of rumors that Pat Williams, the Montana Democrat who's chairing the subcommittee concerned with the endowment, is taking this independent report and trying to rally support behind it. He told me that's what he might do, but he's got not very much time to do it.
How is this report and the Senate legislation being received in the arts community?
Well, it's getting mixed reviews. It's better than some of the heavy restriction amendments that have been proposed, but people are still concerned that obscenity is a question that's being addressed in the legislation. They don't want to see it there.
Stephen Salisbury, thank you very much. Stephen Salisbury is a reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Fresh Air's reviews and readings are produced by Naomi Person. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor and Monty Python alum John Cleese joins us with his therapist, Robin Skinner. The pair co-wrote a book on family therapy. Also, Don Byron tells us how a black clarinetist ended up playing Jewish klezmer music. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.